So we're here with Elena Lamberti's book.
Still loving it. Still loving it.
And the title is?
Yeah, McLuhan Mosaic. Yeah, don't forget that. I have it opened up on...
Marshall McLuhan's Mosaic.
Okay.
Subtitled, Probing the Literary Origins of Media Studies.
Very good. Okay, so we got all the way up to the fourth chapter the other day, and it's going a little bit faster because we're recognizing the repetition and just continuing on. So we're on page 78. And
are we getting a bad echo here?
It's just because of our phones, but it's not a bad echo at
all. Okay,
all
right.
I'm good with it.
So we're starting a new chapter?
It's called Let the Guru Resound. And they don't put the S as a capital like we would with all our re things.
Right.
Resound. When I spell any word with R-E, I automatically make the third letter a capital.
Right, after the R-E.
Mm-hmm. So it starts with the guru's guru. And what I clipped was just within the first paragraph. McLuhan was not, as the students also imply, in favor of those counterculture toot court or two court, T-O-U-T.
Completely in favor. And but McLuhan was not, as the same students also imply, in favor of those countercultures completely.
Completely to court. Neither was he against them. Yeah, he was neither. He was on the fence. He was pointing things out. He wasn't having an opinion.
Right.
Continuing, those who considered McLuhan as one of them, be they Fry's anti-intellectuals or activists, comma, were but interpreting his oracular pronouncements one way. McLuhan was both inside and outside his time. And like Poe's Mariner, he also had some fun in doing it. His playful detachment made him popular, that is, trustable, among very different audiences alike. Now, why does she say that? Because you laugh with someone, you trust them?
Because he could appear not fanatic by speaking to different kinds of people, like I do.
Mm-hmm.
And he didn't have a point of view, so people thought he was rather detached, which was odd for a public intellectual to look so detached in those early years, late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
There was something curious about it. I don't know if it's trustable, but they were puzzling over why this guy didn't seem to have an axe to grind.
Yes, so they would that caused them to be, the audience, to be a little detached and listen maybe a little harder because he was an anomaly.
Right.
Continuing. Today, it is easier for us to realize that McLuhan's broader vision enabled him to guide others through the maze of the electric age. He helped to bring some light, and that is what a guru does.
Now, the thing is, his detachment, because the electric environment and the global theater was affecting everybody, you know, hundreds of cultures.
Mm-hmm.
He would say that you can't blame people's stupid reactions because it's been the process all through history that the culture never knew what its own technologies were doing to it.
Yeah, they never knew what hit them.
So he came around and offered patterns in the context of each culture, each medium environment, each modern phenomenon, each ancient phenomenon.
Yeah.
That's his, what I call quadrophenia. He was useful to everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right. They could use his words for their own purposes because he didn't have a point of view about them, so they could make them their own.
He wasn't judging people, which was another new thing for a public intellectual because they were used to the hot intellectuals of the 30s and 40s and 50s and the Cold War, the communists against the capitalists, and everybody judging everybody. Mm-hmm. And being angry, he had a playfulness.
Yeah, that's true. Third paragraph. Imagine that it is the late 1960s in Toronto and that you're crossing St. Michael's campus. All of the sudden you see...
No, rushing to your next class.
I know, I'm leaving out words.
But that's a student. A student is rushing to their next class or meeting.
All of a sudden you see John Lennon and Yoko Ono arriving at the coach house and entering Marshall McLuhan Center for Culture and Technology. then imagine that happening on a regular basis, a never-ending procession of celebrities from both the corporate or institutional world and the world of countercultures entering McLuhan's temple at the University of Toronto. So McLuhan was more than just the media guru. He was the guru's guru, discussing the future of communication and technology with other popular people as diverse as Lord Beaverbrook, Keith Carradine, and Pierre Trudeau. So that's enough there.
Well, no, McLuhan was a sought-after figure for both young rebels and representatives of the most traditional institutions. For example, Ted Carpenter got alienated, his old buddy got alienated when he saw a picture of McLuhan sitting on some Washington dais with Vice President Hubert Humphrey in the middle of the Vietnam War holding up. He thought McLuhan had copped out, but mm-hmm. that was the point. McLuhan affected or would be seen with anybody. Mm-hmm. Because he knew everybody was involved in a new unknown projection of human ingenuity mm-hmm. that created great ambiguity. Mm-hmm. So he was available to everybody. He was, here comes everybody.
Mm-hmm.
So everybody came to him. And that he was dropped pretty quickly, though. This only happened for a few years.
Right, yeah.
And so the flood stopped. Let's see. He was in demand among both those who believed in and defended the establishment and those who wanted to turn it upside down. Mm-hmm. And both sides, you know, believed in him. Mm-hmm. In that, McLuhan, the media guru, was unique. At a time of dramatic technological change, he was perceived as a lighthouse by all sorts of mariners lost in the new media maelstrom. It is as if both President Obama and Sarah Palin went to the same spin doctor.
Yeah.
See, that was a good part to read.
Yeah, and that was probably the first time that that sort of juxtaposition was happening.
It certainly was. you know, nobody mixed high culture and low culture like he did.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So then she goes on, elaborates.
You know, I was just thinking, try to think of a polarity. So he goes on CBC with a bunch of high school students, and they, in their ignorance and naivety and enthusiasm, you know, he ends up pairing with these ignorant kids, you know, but he's there in the pit with them mm-hmm. and offering them insights, being mysterious for them. And the next day, he's writing to Trudeau about how to have a national television conference where Trudeau can do something. Mm-hmm. Get across his message, and then the next day John Lennon drops in, then the next day he's talking to me and I'm talking about the Secret Council 10, and the next day he's giving a lecture at a think tank, the Bilderbergers.
Yeah.
See, from Bilderbergers to kids, local kids in the high school. That's pretty.
Very good, Bob. We get it.
That's
get
pretty
it.
Amazing. I think that's a model for all of us.
We get it, Bob.
Yeah. Okay.
So then further on. After the Obama-Sarah Palin, the middle of the next paragraph, see this one. Through his language, he brought the opposites together. Quote, computers are the LSD of the corporate word was a perfect probe that he coined to epitomize what stood beyond that holism, something that he defined as the depth-involving newness of his time.
Right. That's a good phrase, depth-involving newness. Computers are the LC of the corporate word. It could be world. I'm not sure. Both are accurate, but it could be computers are the LC of the corporate world.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So then right below that, his media guru mask prevailed and was soon translated into an icon, which crystallized McLuhan into the, quote, high priest of pop cult and metaphysician of media, quote. This definition was offered as an introduction to a famous interview published by Playboy magazine in 1969, which consolidated McLuhan's fame worldwide, but which also led to the misunderstanding later recalled by Northrop Frye. So, yeah, you've often talked about that Playboy interview, how it was pretty pivotal for propping him up and then tearing him down.
Right. Mm-hmm. And Northrop Frye said it epitomized the trivialization of McLuhan, because Northrop Frye took McLuhan seriously. He was his colleague in the English department, and he really valued early McLuhan, but he didn't really like this moving into the TV pop culture world. He was a bit suspicious of that. But Fry himself, in the 70s, when they had to calm down the revolution that McLuhan inspired, they bring out this dull, boring chartered accountant guy named Northrop Frye, and they give him a 10 TV-hour series explaining Canada to Canadians.
They give who?
Northrop Frye.
Oh, God.
He gets to have, like, a long series.
You mean instead of McLuhan?
Yeah.
Oh.
And McLuhan by then was unpredictable. He was being condemned in Parliament, 1969-70, by the Governor General, even though they gave him the Governor General Award. So it was all mixed up. And they need the establishment of what somebody who thought they were the establishment thought they had to calm it down. So they brought on boring Northrop Frye, and he gave Canadians an identity for themselves.
Right.
They were a land of chartered accountants. This is what he said Canada was. Jeez.
Yeah.
No wonder we got out of there as much as possible,
adding
fast as possible.
Adding up the taxes to give away in social welfare.
Right. You hear that? And no wonder we go there as many times as possible, as much as possible.
Okay, so there he was setting the stage for awesomeness, and they had to stop him.
Yeah.
Just like they had to stop
the Queen started
you and me.
Yeah, we were replaying it, like Prince Philip. No, yeah, the husband of the Queen. He had a big conference in the castle there, one of the castles, and McLuhan spoke there. But right after that, the Queen's agent, or Prince Philip's agent, Jonathan Miller, did this hit job book on McLuhan in 1971, a ridiculous book. And then a bunch of other bad books came out about McLuhan, and he was... he even told me around that time, I was talking to his brother, who was his front man in the front of the office, and he said, well, we're laying low for the next while. We're not going to be going out there around the world. We're just going to be doing stuff here locally. Mm-hmm. So they knew how to, you know, ebb and flow with his own spotlight.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, toward the end of the second paragraph after that, if you can find this, he's talking about Eastern and Western traditions. He's saying, together they could work out and engage with the evolving sensibility of the global village, an environment which was now shared by all cultures alike, and which McLuhan defined as the fourth world of instant communication embracing all the pre-existing worlds.
You know the other worlds?
1, 2, and 3.
Yeah, do you know them? You don't know the first world.
What, print?
No, the first world was the leading edge of capitalism, the corporate world, you know,
okay.
Exxon, General Motors, the advanced capitalism. That's the first world. The second world was Russian bureaucracy in East Germany, wherever the communists were, China and Soviet Union. They're bogged down, slow bureaucracies, which were premised on they gave justice to people. They weren't ripping them off like capitalists did, like the first world did. So you had a cold war between the first world and the second world. The third world is the ghetto where they fought a lot of the hardware wars. It's the undeveloped world, the third world nations, they call it, right? That's the third world.
Okay.
But the fourth world was not a chemical body world like the first, second, and third. It was the discarnate, super-angelic, electric world, the computerized global theater that went around everybody, the beginning of the virtual economy, and caused crisis in the first world, the second world, and the third world, even to the point the second world collapsed in 1989.
Right. Now, I'm sure I've heard about fourth world before, but that sounds strangely new to me. So are we in a fifth world now?
Yes.
Ion?
No, the fifth, ion's a six. My chart has five levels. So the fifth world is the Android meme. The hexatic or sixth world is iondom.
Wow.
It's you and me, unstoppable, you know, completing the work of Zappa, LaRouche, Thompson, Croker, McLuhan, May Brussel, Dr. Peter, Garrett Dean, Christian Murdy, Cosmic Awareness, and Herbert W. Armstrong,
hey,
and Club
well
22.
Done.
That's
well
what
done.
We're doing. We're completing them, the final outsiders who actually pull off and become the new patent office. Actually, pull it off.
And the last phrase in the next paragraph, the media guru guides you out of environmental ignorance. So I can say I do that about medicine, and you certainly do it about everything else.
Yeah, well, then that Christian Northrup Women to Women book, mm-hmm. you say you're a mediacologist, mm-hmm. and you're the first doctor in the world to say that.
Right.
And that was said in 1999-2000. Almost 20 years ago, you know, yeah, you were a mediacologist studying the effects of the environment. So you specialized in medical artifacts,
mm-hmm.
medical phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
I did the rest because I was not a specialist, too lazy to be a specialist,
yeah.
right?
Too many. Yeah. People often ask me when they hear I'm a doctor, they say, oh, is your husband a doctor too? And I say, no, he's too smart for that.
Yes, that's the right answer.
Yep.
So that last paragraph, we can now approach the mosaic, says Lamberti, as the interface through which the dialogue between Western and Eastern cultural traditions is consciously enacted. See, that's how big a level. McLuhan is like floating around the planet as Sputnik Man, consulting all the different borderlines in media and countries and cultures.
Mm-hmm.
It constitutes a new space where he was, through which lights disperse shadows and the media guru guides you out of environmental ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
It's quite a big, you could say, it's the final anthropomorphic chemical body projection of wisdom.
Yeah,
because it was
yeah.
going to be superseded by the Andor meme, which he predicted.
Yeah, yeah, it's the last gasp of humans defining what's going on before they're subsumed.
Right, and the Christians would say, or Herbert W. Armstrong would say, it's man relying on his own wisdom and ignoring God.
Uh-huh.
You know, and none of it will work, Nelson used to tell me, Nelson Dahl. It's all going to collapse, Bob. Until men get right with God, forget any joker that's out there.
Well, it certainly didn't work for him.
No.
But we are a new breed, you and me, Bob.
Yep.
New breed. The next, the heading on the next section, redefining space.
Now, oh, here's a good point.
Yep.
He was very influenced, the biographies say, by Cambridge in the 30s, and where he studied what was called New Criticism. What they did is they started to look at poetry and prose and written artifacts with multi-semantic in mind, multiple meanings. Whereas, you know, the generation before that were looking for one-leveled, univocal meaning in things,
right.
taking things literal. So I.A. Richards and F.R. Leavis, these professors over there, Malcolm Forbes, or Malcolm somebody like that, Forbes, I think, they were influenced by T.S. Eliot, Pound, and Finnegan's Wake, and Ulysses, this multi-leveled, new kind of creativity. So McLuhan later said that he learned about multi-semantic levels in Cambridge, but then he developed in the 50s multi-spatial communication,
mm-hmm.
not limited to books. Mm-hmm. The space is created by different media, so multi-spatial. Now, it's way more than just refining New Criticism. New Criticism was just multi-semantic within language. So this is what he's doing here, redefining space
mm-hmm.
and pointing out the different kinds of spaces that cultures created through their media.
Mm.
So that's the deep point here.
Yeah. And does that have to do with the space-time?
Yeah, space-time. Like absolute space, absolute time was Newtonian ideas.
Uh-huh.
Then that fell apart when the electric telegraph came in, so Einstein had to update it, and he turned that visual grid, mathematical grid, into a curved sculptural space. He was responding to the tactility of the electric media.
Mm-hmm.
So he created a relative, not absolute, went to a relative space-time mm-hmm. continuum.
Theory of relativity.
Right. And then things were changing so fast. But, you know, 20 years later, in the famous Copenhagen conference in 1927, these other guys, these upstarts, started bringing in photonic knowledge and quantum mechanics. And that sort of went against or caused a problem for Einstein. So already Einstein was being altered by new models, by new physics, because of new media environments beyond what he had in 1900.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's interesting. I'm reading a guy now. Our foster daughter sent me some YouTubes of this neurosurgeon-turned-quantum mechanic researcher, investigator, Jack Kraus. And he's going on about quantum energy and how it's all about the sun and the photons going into the eyes and affecting the body, and that's what's wrong with us. And it's again the specialist trip where they're just looking at the physics of these photons and the quantumness of it and not realizing, well, if energy is supposed to do something in the body, it requires electrons. Electrons are either donated or accepted.
What? Usinated?
Donated.
Mm-hmm.
Electrons are donated or taken up by minerals. And so in order for the quantum theory to work, you have to look at the biochemistry of what we're doing, the whole mineral thing. So they completely forget the ground. They go off
under the enthusiasm and hypnotism of the new medium.
Yeah.
There's many media since the quantum metaphor. There were New Agers writing books about the quantum society 10, 15, 20 years ago. Yeah. We're now into string theory and parallel dimensions, which would be caused by the multi-body model that I've made. Mm. Our media is many bodies, so people can have a perception of different realms, dimensions, and worlds. So the quantum metaphor doesn't work anymore.
Right, and it's a rearview mirror that some people in medicine, like this Crouse guy, they're getting all involved in and getting hundreds, well, not hundreds of thousands, but thousands of followers who are all stunned, the bright light of brilliance shining in their eyes. They're all taken up with all these words.
Yeah.
And there's no practicality.
And they're responding because they've been massaged by the media that evoked the quantum model, 100 years ago, 1927.
Uh-huh.
9 years ago, and that's easily understandable because it's a rearview mirror. They're responding to the radio universe.
Right.
They have no perception of the post-virtual, post-Android meme of the six-bodied reality we're in, and that requires up-to-date perception, which they're not going to get. Mm-hmm. So they don't respond to our physics metaphor, which mm-hmm. is ion.
Right. So let's see what Lamberti says about redefining space. McLuhan's idea of depth involving newness is based on a renewed approach to space, which he developed by juxtaposing Eastern philosophies, Western physics, and as we will further explore in the following chapter, modernist experiments.
That's the vortices.
Yeah.
Pound and Eliot and Joyce and Lewis.
Yeah.
Now, I don't agree with that.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, a renewed approach to space, which he developed by juxtaposing Eastern concepts and Western concepts. No, he realized the spatial dynamics caused by media environments and why the non-alphabetic Eastern Asian space had a different idea of the cosmos than the literate West.
Right.
He explained the difference between the West and the East. So she's mixing up the fact he's talking about them, the differences, and explaining the ground to their differences. And she sees that, no, he's being encyclopedic on a generalist level and discussing different mixed concepts from different cultures.
Okay, so she's just saying the cultures are mixed together, and that's what McLuhan was doing. That was his focus, but it wasn't. It wasn't just about the cultures. It was
about
the media.
It wasn't about the cultural content.
Yeah.
She says it was a bold juxtaposition which immediately resonated with the counterculture holism of the 1670s when cross investigations of apparently unrelated, if not opposing, fields of study were encouraged. The counterculture holism was a result of television and then the global theater, where McLuhan said the new tactile mosaic mesh made kids want to be holistic.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't the concept of holism that McLuhan was pointing out. It was the fanatic desire for holism as a concept evoked by this holistic tactile mesh started off with black and white TV.
Mm-hmm.
In other words,
fill it in.
Yeah, on the cartoon level, people were starting to feel cosmic, and they wanted to come up with cosmic ideas. And so this Jack Cruz guy, he's mixing it up, stepping out of the box of his medical specialism and bringing in concepts from other fields. He's just gingerly starting to juxtapose different fields of information mm-hmm. that McLuhan had done 60 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And Jack is not talking about the ground.
Mm-mm, oh, gosh, no. Never. Okay.
Which is now you. You're the ground in medicine now.
Yeah.
With your technologies.
Yeah, so at the end of that paragraph, she's saying, based on his interdisciplinary approach, the Tao of physics became a revealing subtext of his later productions, and especially of Marshall and Eric McLuhan's laws of media. I don't know if that's true.
No, it isn't. This is where she's mixing up fads of success, like that book, The Tao of Physics, which was written in Jack Sarfatti's home or apartment or with Jack Sarfatti's guidance over the Tao of Physics. I remember seeing the book on McLuhan's desk in the main seminar room in the late 70s while he was reading that, while reading William Burroughs' latest stuff. Now, he was not impressed with the concepts. He would read these books and why they became fads, and he figured out what qualities in the mediascape evoked these concepts, similar concepts, in the Tao of Physics.
Mm-hmm.
So he wasn't lost in a conceptual interdisciplinary approach.
Yeah.
That's what they do in universities. They take media studies, and they don't look at the forms. They look at the contents, and so people can be in anthropology and do a paper on Madonna. You know, that's called interdisciplinary. And they're just looking at the content generalization, not the media mix.
Right. Very good.
So, yeah, she doesn't seem to get the point, and that's partly because she's a teacher. She must stay loyal to cultural content to have a role for her body.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah, yeah, and there are very few people to this day who get it like you get it.
Well, I don't have any stake in the matter. I don't have any specialism to defend.
Right.
So I can actually see what he's saying.
Right. Now, in the next paragraph, she's going into, quote, his field approach or field.
Yeah, now that's a multimedia, multispatial approach, and he called it a mosaic of fields. So she's got the right term there.
Right.
Let's see if she does it right, or does she stay into the content. She does occasionally go to the formal level. She gets it right.
Mm-hmm.
Then she slips back to content and makes statements that even you find weak.
Or even me.
There, where you say, the Tao of Physics became a revealing subtext of his later productions? No.
No, not so much.
No.
So in the middle of the next paragraph, his field approach dismissed the classic physics idea of space.
That's Newtonian.
And embraced the new quantum physics concept of space-time. Bracket literally, the fourth dimensional continuum of one temporal and three spatial coordinates in which any event or physical object is located, unquote. Who's she quoting there?
I don't know. Don't really recognize it. The four-dimensional continuum of one temporal and three spatial coordinates in which any event or physical object is located. I don't think McLuhan said that. That's what McLuhan is explaining, the new kinetic, proprioceptive, acoustic and tactile intermix, multispatial interplay leads to physicists getting a little confused and saying the four-dimensional continuum of one temporal and three spatial in which anything is located. You know, that's
well, that's just that in space you have to have three points in order to locate.
In visual space.
Visual space.
And McLuhan, he threw into the dustbin the whole physics enterprise by saying these guys can't get over the fact that they're taking these new spaces caused by electric media and trying to put them back into visual space.
Yeah.
Like they're a stick in the muds.
And then the whole thing that we've incorporated from ION is there is no time.
Nor space.
Nor space. There just isn't.
Yeah, but you've got to prove it. If you're a visual guy, you come tell someone that, they say, what are your sources? You've got to show them a few books that you read or a couple of papers you got off the Internet, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And but that's the slower world of money and banking. Prove who you are.
Yeah.
You know, the newfie, they ask him for his ID. He pulls out a pocket mirror, looks at himself in the mirror and says, yeah, that's me.
Yeah.
No, that's not good enough. You got to have your ID. You got to have your visual coordinates.
Well, that type of dialogue, prove it, is just a shutdown. They stop the conversation. They declare a win because they know you can't prove it.
Right. So Thompson used to try to mix the cultural content, you know, art, science, religion, and the occult. And he'd come up with interesting patterns, but he wouldn't go as far as McLuhan saying, so that Thompson would read modern physics, William Henry Thompson, LaRouche, mm-hmm. and Croker, and they'd adapt the concepts to their theories and conceptual mm-hmm. framework with a little bit of media percept thrown in. But McLuhan would say, you're trying to take a post-visual situation and you're working for all of the Gutenberg galaxy, all the old media, which is now concretized into the university as the new city, and you're just propping up that old environment, that archetype, as I posted yesterday, that literary archetype, that archetype of a Gutenberg environment. Everybody's working for that environment. Mm-hmm. So therefore, they're working for the idea that you're one person and not another person. You have one name, and you can't change your names. All that supports the Rockefellers and the bankers, which can't get pull off their economy anymore because they mm-hmm. refuse to recognize the virtual situation we're in.
Right. Okay, let's see what else she says.
Which is what McLuhan was pointing to, the virtual situation.
Right. After she says, his field approach dismissed the classic physics idea of space and embraced the new quantum physics concept of space-time continuum.
No, he didn't embrace. See, just because he read about these guys,
mm-hmm.
he was not embedded in the 20th century. Some people think, well, that's because he was a Catholic. No, don't limit to being a Catholic.
But it looks like she corrects him then. After the bracket, she says, it is, in fact, a more dynamic approach through which all investigated situations are considered to be shifting, their state depending on the constant interaction between things and people, as well as environmental conditions.
Well, that's a pretty bulky way to explain McLuhan, what she's been doing all along, and all she's by this time should just say he was looking at the new spaces, the media-generated spaces, that created ideas like new quantum physics,
mm-hmm.
who were just physicists trying to visualize it, but it was getting pretty complex, electrons being in two places at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
How are they going to visualize that? And if you go and study, you know, quantum physics or math of the mid-60s, 56 years, they got into really strange situations in what they described. They got pretty complex for students.
Right.
And you end up with that girl that
in the wall,
yeah, who at Yale heard these mm-hmm. ideas back, you know, 15 years ago, whatever the scientists, teachers were telling her, she started thinking there were parallel worlds, so she goes to a few parallel worlds but doesn't know how to get back mm-hmm. and gets stuck in the wall of some building at Yale.
Yeah.
There'll be more about that tonight. I think it's explained on tonight's private session. But see, so she is... She's sort of beating around the bush by saying, well, he embraced new quantum physics. No, he never embraced anything. He just saw that they were a figure for a ground. Mm-hmm. Then she tries to say, yeah, there is. Like I said, she does get into the formal level and says, yeah, there's actually a more dynamic approach looking at the media ground. And so she's sort of over-explaining what she's been explaining for 80 pages and repeating the explanation and not getting to the punchline. Right at this point, she should say, McLuhan was not embracing new quantum physics. He was actually finding its problems, its limitations, because the guys creating the physics weren't aware of the dynamics in the media that make them think that way.
Well, let's see what her next sentence is. In such a vision, the linear concept of distance is replaced by the acoustic idea of interval, meaning the space of interaction through which both action and reaction, bracket, that is, interactive communication, are activated.
She's still dealing with the media effects as concepts.
Yeah.
She's not. She hasn't mentioned the TV mosaic yet.
Right.
That everything is trying to visualize.
This functional idea of bringing together quantum physics and Eastern cultures was often developed through paradoxes, which challenged logic and encouraged indeterminacy and relativity. Yeah. So it's just more and more examples, more words.
Right, and more concepts. So the quote, now this is from McLuhan,
Yeah. The
modern physicist is at home with Oriental field theory. He's not saying that's great. He's saying the damn modern physicist is still stuck within his Gutenberg discipline, and he's trying to relate new media effects back into the Newton and Einsteinian model and the Copenhagen model, and not recognizing that the new actual physical science is media laws that McLuhan was developing.
Mm-hmm.
There's new natural environments that you have to study the effects of, not just the radiation and all that stuff in first nature. There's spaces and worlds created by new media that science should be looking at.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't use visual models.
Mm-hmm.
You can actually just say, look, there is a new ground, a new technical ground happening, because everybody's changing their disciplines and coming up with new theories. What's prompting them to come up with certain theories that resonate with the hidden mechanical ground or electronic ground?
Right, yeah, what's the impetus?
So she says, she gives that quote, the modern physicist is at home with Oriental field theory, but not at home with McLuhan, I add. And then she has another quote. The method of the 20th century is to use not a single, but multiple models for experimental explorations. The technique is suspended judgment. He's explaining why people are adopting the tetrad manager, the technique suspended judgment,
mm-hmm.
and how it was already done first by the vorticists, Pound and Joyce. They were ahead of the scientists. But the scientists and the engineers, if you meet them in the universities in that period, 60s, 70s, they say, well, oh, that's a bunch of failed books. They don't get how their world is being exposed by James Joyce.
Right, and it wasn't until the past 30 years that the physicists seemed to catch up, and then everyone was all excited that the physicists were going Oriental.
Well, here's the one ironic situation. In 1963, Murray Gell-Mann, I think that's his name, famous quantum physicist, he decided that the new particles, that their new technologies were revealing, they wouldn't see these particles unless they had the technologies, so they're extensions of the technology. So he said, we got to name this new thing. And he named it quark.
Mm-hmm.
And he got the word from, I think it's page 403 of Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
So he was actually the top physicist, one of the top guys, was looking at Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
But they weren't reading McLuhan. They weren't realizing that Joyce was a scientist. He was just looking for weird words.
Mm-hmm.
And he found quark, and he got it from Finnegan's Wake. So what is it? They couldn't avoid Joyce. You know, they didn't use Joyce properly, but they had to use him to name their new scenario.
They had to give him a nod.
Right.
Okay, so...
Or they just felt it instinctively.
Right.
So she lays down those two quotes.
Right.
Then she says, it is an idea. So this functional idea, it's not an idea. It's an approach at looking at the weather and the new technological weather. You're using your percepts, not a concept.
Mm-hmm.
But she says it's an idea which also reconfigures the role of the players, be it the Western scientist or the Eastern philosopher, because they are asked to choose their understanding of the paradox, be it the uncanny result of an experiment or the ambiguous riddle of a koan. And they're asked to do that from among a network of meaningful alternatives which are all possible at the same time. In both domains, the paradox is therefore applied as a strategy to accommodate what in appearance is disconnected or unrelated, but which in fact is not. Now, she's just going to climb back up and say this is acoustic space, maybe a little tactility, and then maybe say the TV environment is tactile. But she's getting bogged down too much in explaining the content effects
mm-hmm.
of television on scientists and Eastern gurus.
Right, right. I am looking for the word television, if she even pulled
in
that in.
Yeah, in this pages.
Right. Okay, well, I mean, what do we do? Because when I'm looking at what I've clipped, just scanning, it is just reinforcing exactly what you just said. A journey inward through poetry, follow-up to Pound's idea of the artist as the antenna of the race. It's a lot of repetition.
Yeah, of sort of not getting to the devastating point.
Yeah, a follow-up to Pound's idea of the artist.
Where is that? Where's this Pound stuff?
Somehow I went backwards.
Okay.
And it all sounded very familiar and similar.
Okay, so you're back a few pages.
Yeah, but now I'm on 81, and somehow my book won't bring
Okay, I don't need to find that. Just read the Pound statement that you were starting to read.
Yeah. Page 80. Now I'm on to Capra.
I know, but go back to the Pound. You can't find it? Let me see, look up pound, what's happening around page 80. Pound 83 and 59. That's too far back, 59.
No, there was just a major glitch here. I apologize. Let's move on.
Right. Well, what do you remember pound saying?
The antenna of the race, you know, that whole...
Oh, okay. Actually, that you went forward. That's page 80. That's the next couple of pages.
Oh, okay.
The cross-reading of artistic situations and production is conceived as a training for readers on how to become active players and how to work out the hidden pattern of forces underpinning one's own visible environment in real time. It is a follow-up to Pound's idea of the artist as the antenna of the race, now updated by McLuhan as the image of art... as the new Do Line, the Canadian hosted American satellite observation against the Soviet Union, distant mm-hmm. early warning system. So McLuhan used that technology as a metaphor for what he was doing. He was doing a distant early warning. And then she just says, a definition which relates to the establishment of a system of radar stations in Arctic Canada during the Cold War. As a new technology, radars replaced the previous barrage balloon system employed as an anti-aircraft environment during the Second World War. To render his idea of how art and literature should now be employed, McLuhan juxtaposes two technological metaphors, each implying a different approach to the way observation is carried out. The balloon system offers a top-down perspective, whereas radar replaces it with full-scale, you know, full all-around 360-degree observation. The former is visually biased or visually based, and as in the Renaissance canvas, perception is oriented in relation to a given visual vantage point, whereas the radar is acoustically based, and as in the painting of the Middle Ages, perception reveals objects all together and simultaneously. That's before the printing press. These two metaphors develop from a different approach to space. Well, it's actually a different approach to media environments, not mm-hmm. space, which is, in fact, a crucial paradigm in defining what we imply by perception. However, as McLuhan notes in his book Through the Vanishing Point, 1968, we are not always aware of space, nor of our relation to it, because we tend to perceive it as an invisible component of our own reality. Then she gives a quote from McLuhan, to contemporary man, space is a cliché, an unexamined assumption. It is environmental, and modern man is therefore unaware of it. Now, he's not talking about space, outer space. He's talking about the spaces created by media environments.
Right.
It is another way of saying that water is unknown to a fish until it discovers air, till it dies. Now, you know, going back to page 82, what's interesting, McLuhan's cross-reading of different domains and his holistic approach. Now, he didn't have a holistic approach. When he looked at books, he looked at how they created a fragmented approach, and then he would understand why subjects and ideas and theories were fragmented of that era. So he wasn't condemning the fragmentation of visual space. He knew why it happened. Then he'd shift to the 20th century and look at tactile extensions like electric environments and see what new ideas and sports enthusiasms that would evoke. So he was holistically looking at all the different media environments. In other words, just looking at them. He didn't have a holistic concept that holistic medicine comes up with, or some kind of integrated cross-disciplinary idea. Mm-hmm. That's still conceptualizing, moving from specialism to generalization, to generalism.
It's trying to make a pattern of what you've got rather than seeing how...
You got to it.
You got to it. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
So then she says... for instance, in her seminal work, The Cosmic Web, subtitled Scientific Field Models and Literary Strategies in the 20th Century, Catherine Hales, now it was her book, How We Became Post-Human, which came after The Cosmic Web, I'm pretty sure, that I was reading when 9/11 happened that morning.
Right.
And I was on page 222. But Catherine Hales, she's been interviewed by Arthur Croker. She's a big deal. And she's a humanist who dared to go into detailed scientific knowledge and make parallels between what was happening in science and what was happening in literature mm-hmm. with a bit of media awareness. But she was redoing McLuhan and taking advantage of the later effects of the Enron meme and calling it post-human,
mm-hmm.
whereas McLuhan called it Planet of the Dead. So... Lambert A. can use Hales because it's similar to what she thinks McLuhan's doing.
Mm-hmm.
Catherine Hales, in her book, describes the isomorphic approach to the idea of field characterized in scientific and humanistic research alike from the turn of the previous century. She defines the characteristics of the new narrative in terms of, quote, its fluid, dynamic nature, the inclusion of the observer, the absence of detachable parts, and the mutuality of component interactions. That's all television.
Wow.
She's describing television, but she doesn't know it.
Dang.
Yeah, so now we can go where you want to go next.
Okay, so we get Pound, and here's an interesting phrase. It's toward the, it's the last paragraph before the next heading, and it's the idea of space of Renaissance man. So
before you read it, what is space of Renaissance man?
I don't know, except
no, how you should know immediately
how they looked at paintings and portraiture.
No, you didn't. You should. What space is? It's visual space enhanced by the printing press. It's that simple.
Right.
And you should. You're getting lost in the concepts here. You should have known that answer immediately.
Immediately.
And you see why you shouldn't have known it, right?
Yeah. Renaissance man.
See, you started looking. Renaissance evoked the habitual images of painting and the arts, and you forgot to look at the technological ground beneath the painting and images that people have of the Renaissance.
Right. And he is talking about, she is talking about paintings here, and then.
What's the weird phrase or something?
I don't know. There's a lot that comes before it, but I just wanted to get into this. It is for this reason that the idea of space of tribal societies, acoustic space, differs from the idea of space of Renaissance man. Similarly, the idea of space of Renaissance man, visual space, differs from that of the individual living in the electric age. So it's just, it's the old juxtaposition and comparison of tribal, Renaissance, and electric.
Right. Ear, eye, and tactility.
Mm-hmm. And the last sentence of that paragraph, as the Italian futurist painter Umberto Boccioni declared, when entering the electric age, individuals become primitives of an unknown culture.
Yeah, now that's an artist sort of picking up the symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Then Wyndham Lewis around that time starts saying, well, we can be more precise in why we appear to be barbarians and a new kind. And he started looking at the media effects and the sensory effects, like early primitive McLuhan is what he was doing. Then McLuhan sort of did it better than Lewis.
Mm.
But primitives of an unknown culture, the extension of electricity, which creates the extension of tactility, is something that humans had not noticed before or ever experienced. Now, an average engineer or a 20th century person will say, well, of course the 20th century is different from the 19th century. We've invented new things. We're progressing. And they're right that it's like McLuhan's taught about something that's obvious, but they don't know how McLuhan talks about it in detail and compares it to other eras, and so we're not necessarily progressing. Just we made these technologies, what makes us these kind of people, and if we turn them off, we could go back to the Renaissance and be print people.
Mm-hmm.
See, they're not getting the shaping of the ones who look at it like on a practical, efficient causality level of McLuhan. They don't get the aesthetics or the new knowledge, new science that McLuhan's coming up with.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the next section, it's...
So, if you're writing, you come across someone who says, well, this is all common sense, and then you read Lamberti's book. It's a good book for the common sense person to realize, oh, I hadn't thought of it all that way,
Absolutely.
So it's a good means to getting to what McLuhan said.
Yeah. People are telling you all the time. It's a great primer.
Right. Go ahead. What were you going to say?
Next section, holistic mosaic, Western science, Eastern philosophy. So it's more repetition, a few lines down. In McLuhan's mosaic, space becomes a structural tenant reflecting...
Tenant.
Structural fact reflecting his perception of the fourth world. So that's our repetition there.
Yeah, he's recognized electric tactility has been extended, creating a new space.
And then she goes into Capra's The tau physics again. And
because he is bringing in Eastern concepts to Western science, that's pretty radical, she thinks.
Yeah, yeah.
But it is still nowhere near the new breakthrough, the real tau of physics is McLuhan's jiu-jitsu.
Mm-hmm. And the last section of that paragraph, in this book, Capper himself challenges the traditional Western scientific discourse through a holistic approach to both nature and the human mind.
It's not a holistic approach. He's being duped by the new electric environment and mm-hmm. criticizing old visual space-based mm-hmm. science, and she's saying it's a holistic approach. It's conceptually acoustic, which is more holistic than visual space, but not necessarily better. But when you have electric media that create a holistic tactile acoustic environment, then you better know what's happening there. Don't think it's better. Just know it's going to change all the concepts of the right. different disciplines.
Right. So
that's the holistic approach. You look at the media grounds, not at some concepts from the East that seem to be more acoustically oriented.
Right. So instead of the literary critic who just says, oh, he had a good thought there.
Yeah.
You know, East and West and all, not looking ever at the environment, electric environment.
McLuhan's point is there's no West and there's no East.
Mm-hmm.
So it becomes an art form, and slow university thinkers can sort of take the obsolete old stuff from around the globe and make a new pattern
mm-hmm.
and get to the 19th century and some of the writers like Flaubert and Mallarmé who influenced Finnegan's Wake, but they don't get to Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm. Continuing on, his premises, Capra's premises, are to be found in the shocking epistemological revolution which physicists began in the late 19th century and which came to full maturity in the first decade of the 20th century.
It's talking about the background to Einstein, and that leads to Einstein. And Mr. Riemann, our I-E-M-A-N-N, back in the mid-19th century, was the physicist who came up with the new ideas that influenced Einstein because he didn't use regular Euclidean geometry. He used the Laroussian thread, Platonic modalities, and British intelligence suppressed the Riemannian influence on Einstein. So that's a more interesting fact than this idea about some revolutionary stuff that was prefigured in the 19th century. So we just brought a little ruse in there for Bob's comprehensive mixing of different quadrants. I'm not mixing Eastern philosophy and Western science. I'm mixing whole media worlds and their appropriate anthropomorphic figures like Thompson, Croker, LaRouche, and McLuhan.
Okay. The next long quote, it looks like it's from the Tao Physics, Capra, about Newtonian mechanics. So I don't...
Read that.
Okay. Newtonian mechanics was for a long time considered to be the final theory for the description of all natural phenomena until electric and magnetic phenomena, which had no place in Newton's theory, were discovered. The discovery of these phenomena showed that the model was incomplete, Newtonian model was incomplete, that it could be applied only to a limited group of phenomena, essentially the motion of solid bodies. Today we know that the Newtonian model is valid only for objects consisting of large numbers of atoms and only for velocities which are small compared to the speed of light. This does not mean that Newton's model is wrong or that quantum theory and relativity theory are right. All these models are approximations which are valid for a certain range of phenomena. The Eastern mystics, too, are well aware of the fact that all verbal description of reality are inaccurate or incomplete.
See, this is very imprecise writing.
Yeah, it's like yes, no, yes, no.
Yes, no,
no
and then
no,
he mixes
no.
in a little Alan Watts mysticism or stuff he got at the Esalen Institute. And Krishna, he was a big student of Krishnamurti. And it's just a badly mixture of concepts and slight percepts, but really not knowing that you can see the percepts through the media of the day.
Mm-hmm.
See, so this is what I was always doing around these guys, saying, you guys are not including McLuhan, which is neither east, west, north, or south.
Mm-hmm. And Liberti says, just after that quote, we can define Capra's approach to knowledge as at once holistic and ecological, because new scientific models integrate and interact with all previous ones. So, you know, she's just putting him in the box of jamming the two cultures together.
And not knowing that he's an effect. Now, that's a university person, not acknowledging the other departments. I never had to acknowledge any departments in my school, but she has to. She's a humanist and acknowledging little breakthroughs over in science world and hoping it illustrates McLuhan, but she doesn't get precise enough about why this fragmented dialogue going on in the university is not appropriate in McLuhan terms. Now, I just came over here. There's a bunch of interesting comments going on we should mention, Carol.
Okay.
Because I know I'm being awesome. And let's just see how people are responding. Let's see. There's a lot.
I get a nod from Sarah.
Yes. let's just move up and there's a couple of insults from Sarah. She accused me of nepotism or something. Then she wants to know who rules Cordovia. And then she goes into Northrop's book. What is Northrop? Northrop Frye?
Maybe Christian Northrop. I don't know.
Yeah, Northrop book has a ludicrous questionnaire which she suggests filling out and presenting the document for one's general practitioner. It's crazy-making. So that's about empath. Yeah, see, the problem with Northrop, she doesn't know the effects of the Android meme on her new ideas of empaths and vampires, you know. So Sarah, hanging around here, knows there's something inadequate in her book.
Look, Sarah at one point says, Bob, stop distracting me.
So that's way earlier. She was trying to leave and go home and turn off the radio, but I kept playing obscure stuff that she's interested in.
Oh, funny. Okay.
It's interesting what she's saying about Northrop. She asks great exploitative medical questions, and once considered, these questions become sorted into issues. No going back. The only choice remaining is present as a hypochondriac, remaining, I guess, for a hypochondriac, is to reluctantly placating MDs or single out, highlight, inwardly dwell on these self-observations, turn into medical issues with no solution. Yeah, that's right. She's saying this is frustrating, the effects of Northrop's book. All right, and kind of compromising with regular medicine and not knowing the new technologies that come out of ION. So let's go to another approach. Here's Ben.
Oh, look, Ben, look, awesome. I met Jack Cruz's followers more often than not. Bob and Carolyn Crumble Cruz, that was Swift.
Right. We did it right there.
Yeah,
Ben is listening to the concepts. And, yes, I was just going to read that. So he met their cult. He's had a bit of a cult, his followers. Maybe he didn't meet Jack Cruz. He met the followers.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Swift. Okay. So then you get Bert says, groundling, Sarah. This is the quick hack for conflict. Holding a stance with all joints bent a bit for as long as you can stand, it will help. This is the quick hack. He's talking about Northrop. Right? For conflict, you know, quick categories like no longer left versus right, it's empaths versus vampires, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a product of our virtual technologies.
But then a bird is giving like an exercise.
Yeah, that's what he's satirizing, that these people are offering some kind of posture. Holding a stance with all joints bent a bit for as long as you can stand it, that will help.
And this whole hack business, like Cruz is a biohacker.
Oh,
and
that's it.
In the blog I'm writing, I'm saying I'm doing a word hack on Cruz.
Right, okay.
I'm a word hacker.
All right, so then Sarah comes back. Carolyn, blessed be she. You know, Sarah just gets swept up by personal charisma. Carolyn, blessed be she, actually full frontally addressed everything nor trumped up for me. And that's I don't know what that means. I had about 10 years to think abstractly and remotely about my declining health while perpetuating the decline with worrisome stress. Then Carolyn gracefully entered and tenaciously attacked each quasi-separate diagnosis as symptoms of what I was, a person with a meat sack and no common sense on maintenance and driving said sack. That's good. So that's...
sad sack.
Yeah. And then we say something and she goes, yes. Yeah, or maybe she's saying it to Bert. And then she goes, Bert, that's what worked. Then she says, I guess the need to apply different stances is the heart of the matter. I want so bad for there to be an infallible pose or poise, something I can go to, but that's a mindset. Okay.
So I think Sarah's saying yes to Bert's
groundling.
Yeah.
And then she says, in the Emerald Tablets, Thoth wrote to send an activation intention to oneself of grounding. He does say, just let it happen first. Then immediately do the command again in a more controlled way. So quite imprecise what she's saying. And then she says, Bob is spot on about nostalgia. I seem to live with an undercurrent of homesickness most of my life. But I am my home. Where can I possibly go to get lost for me? Mm-hmm. Yes, that's a psychological, conceptual idea of what's going on. But look at the environments and the fact you grew up with the beginning of the sixth body environment. That's what creates a confused nostalgia and homesickness for one body or the other.
Mm-hmm.
To perceive that should give you some poise. So that's all we have in their responses at this point.
Very good. Okay.
So back to the book.
Back to the text. So the end of that last paragraph we were looking at, just want to say, Eric McClune recalls that working on a new edition of Understanding Media, his father started by reviewing its most severe criticisms. He found that some of the most recurring criticisms seemed to form a chorus of, that's all very well for you, but it's not scientific. So this is leading into the laws of media. Hence, laws of media stands as a paradoxical challenge to that accusation.
Yeah, where are you? Where's that all said?
Well, we just did the Newton quote, so it's into the next paragraph.
Right. Right, and Eric McLuhan, yes, says that. See, so they're saying that is not scientific. Well, they mean it doesn't involve certain technologies that they work with in their labs or in their engineering studios and all the different environments they build. And they're talking about building objects almost. And they're not looking at the effects of the object and the unforeseen environment, the object building railroad that they build efficiently through efficient cause. They don't look at the formality, the formal cause of the effects on people and cultures around that new invention.
Right.
So it's like, don't look at the effects. That's not scientific.
Mm-hmm.
You must keep praying that science is going somewhere and keep inventing. And I remember a geneticist said,
science doesn't look at the effects.
I know, but wait a minute. The geneticist said to the evergreens, of course we're making mistakes all the time, but this is how we progress. So that's the bias of the practical scientist. Now, they do have Hazel Henderson. Remember, you spoke to her once, a friend of William Irwin Thompson. She became a member of the Office of Technology Assessment. They actually do, by the 80s, media ecology. They start trying to study the effects, but it's quite limited, and they stay in a more practical level. They're not saying, rap happened because of the technology. You know, they're not looking across the culture. They're trying to say, well, we got a lot of pollution. How can we have these new technologies not cause as much pollution? So it's limited practicality in the efficient cause world. It's like engineering allowed a bit of dialogue about what they were doing. And that was due, from McLuhan's scientific point of view, that the global ecological movement was a result of the planet being extended by the satellite. And the satellite put the whole planet into the content of the satellite environment, the global theater, and therefore everybody was in a world of ricocheting effects, echoing all over the place. So they naturally became pre-litter and tribal and holistic looking at the environment in a naive way and what it was causing. Hence Earth Day in 1970, hence Pollution Probe, hence all the environmental rules and the separating of your garbage into the blue box and the gray box. These are all local effects of the satellite environment.
So this new office.
So, you know, you can't say that that engineers don't study the effects. They have whole departments on it now in government. But it's all done within bureaucratic review mirror and obsolete techniques.
What's this Office of Technology in effect?
No, look up Office of Technology Assessment.
Assessment. I'm not finding anything.
Well, you didn't do that.
Yeah.
Office of Technology Assessment. I think that's the title.
Office of Technology Assessment, Wikipedia, Office of the U.S. Congress from 1972 to 1995, so it is no more, Bob.
Right, right.
OTA's purpose was to provide congressional members and committees with objective and authoritative analysis of the complex scientific and technical issues of the late 20th century. It was a leader in practicing and encouraging delivery of public services in innovative and inexpensive ways, including early involvement in the distribution of government documents through electronic publishing. So it's crap.
Yeah, it's crap. And, but Hazel Henderson, an alternative economist,
uh-huh.
had some different ideas out of the box. That's where she is, like the best she could get was get stuck on that committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it was closed down. They thought it was redundant. It mimicked the work of other branches, but nobody ever assessed what the environment was doing, what the technology of the environment was doing at all. So,
and here's a really good example. I found it from the Evergreens in the late 80s that a member of the military branch of intelligence in Baltimore, he